Thank you for inviting me to this symposium, and in particular, thanks to Nancy for that wonderful exposition. I was hoping that you would cover a lot of this ground, and you covered more than I could hope for, because can everybody hear me? My reading is much more literary. I'm going to do readings of literary texts in the French medieval tradition, where genius comes back as an allegorical figure, but of course with its roots in classical antiquity. And I just didn't have time to fit all of that in. So I think this follows up wonderfully. And in particular, I will hopefully show how he takes on Christian garments in the French medieval and Renaissance period. So my presentation derives from a larger interest in literary figures of biological and poetic generative continuity, and the way in which they are exploited by French medieval and early modern writers to convey a desire to be part of a lineage of authors in whose heritage to inscribe their work by imitation, while at the same time giving voice to a need for immortality of their own name. More specifically, I'm interested in this process from a textual perspective, namely in the way in which the poet strives to mirror in language physical begetting, whereby literary language mimes the process of biological reproduction and allows the poet to glorify authorship as linguistic procreation. I was struck by a connection between this authorial role in linguistic replenishment and the rise and the expansion of the French vernacular between the Middle Ages and Renaissance, in particular as seen against the background of belligerent threat and warfare. My research focuses on three authors: Jean de Meung, he's a 13th century poet; Jean Lemaire de Belge, Lemaire, I will just call him Lemaire in this talk, I'm sorry I don't have this on PowerPoint, L-E-M-A-I-R-E, who is an early 16th century poet, and François Rabelais, who you probably know, is also early 16th century. And their works evince the interplay between physical procreation and poetic begetting in language, and feature the author as the creator of linguistic fertility in the vernacular. The allegorical genius character plays a crucial role in these textual and social historical intersections, and this is the topic I'd like to talk about in the context of today's symposium. Genius as a fertilizing author figure in Jean de Meung's poem The Romans of the Rose, written between 1270 and 1280, is continued in Lemaire's text called The Concord of the Two Languages from 1511, where genius character is given a prominent role in celebrating the French and Italian vernaculars, the two languages, and is referred to in Rabelais' staging of the Diogenes figure in the prologue to his so-called third book from 1546. All these three writers stage an allegorical genius author as linguistic reproducer under circumstances of both real and metaphorical warfare or belligerent threat. In Jean de Meung's Romans of the Rose, physical and poetic procreation are closely related to allegorical combat. This connection is reiterated in Lemaire's and Rabelais' authorial personae, Genius and Diogenes, who assure linguistic fertility in the vernacular on a par as a parallel to physical procreation of the species in a belligerent context. They are referring in particular to the precarious situation of France in the early 16th century under menace from outside forces. For time's sake, I will limit myself today to discussing the genius figure in Jean de Meung and Lemaire de Belge's text in order to underline the continuity between Middle Ages and Renaissance, and I'll be happy to elaborate on Rabelais perhaps during the discussion session. Jean de Meung's Romans of the Rose is really the narrative continuation of the allegorical poem of courtly love, the first 4,000 verses of which were written several decades earlier, in the 13th century, by a poet called Guillaume de Loris. This poem, a true medieval art of love, first narrates in the conventional schemes of courtly love how an allegorical lover in his dream enters a marvelous garden populated with a variety of allegorical characters, such as beauty, pleasure, jealousy, courteousness, etc. The lover sees a beautiful rose, which becomes the object of his conquest and desire. It's cut off abruptly after jealousy locks the rose in a castle guarded by love's enemies. Jean de Meung picks up at this point. His part, more than four times longer, narrates the siege of the castle by the forces of love, life, and procreation, amongst whom genius, their final success, and the lover's allegorical picking of the rose, which is sexual intercourse. Yet radically alters the nature of the poem into a medieval encyclopedia by inserting a learned and didactic digression spoken by the allegorical characters, and more importantly, by unveiling the initial courtly setup of the quest for the rose as a hypocritical disguise for the divinely ordained natural procreation of the human species through sex. Guillaume's and Jean's combined text of the Romance of the Rose would remain one of the most popular bestsellers of French vernacular poetry for centuries to come. Jean de Meun also adds the allegorical character genius to the poem, in a role that I believe seeks to symbolize poetic authorship. In order to understand genius author role, we first need to look at the poem's intersection of procreation, warfare, and authorship. While in Guillaume's version, the lover invariably speaks in the first person singular, we hear the story of the lover narrated, thus conflating the narrator with the lover. Jean de Meun's varies between an I lover, the lover in the first person, and a poet in the first person, talking about the lover in the third person. In other words, the difference between a first person character and an author or narrator. One of these shifts acquires special meaning because it takes place during a decisive scene of allegorical combat for the conquest of the rose. After an initial attempt to touch the rose, the lover has been thrown out of the castle of love by danger, fear, and shame. In the ensuing combat, love's forces are so severely threatened by defeat that they need to call for a truce and request Venus's help. The lover's allegorical conquest of the rose in the garden now transcends to a level of universal battle between the forces of nature, life, and procreation, against their antithetical opponents, such as danger, jealousy, but also chastity, abstinence, and death. A shift of narrative point of view takes place at the same time. The je lover, the I lover, who spoke in the first person, who had been an active participant in the action so far, falls back into a motionless, almost paralyzed state of contemplation. Jean de Meun seizes this particular opportunity to impose his voice of poet-narrator and directly addresses the reader. His capturing of the narrator's voice is followed by dazzling but grotesque and ridiculously copious descriptions of allegorical combat, a poetic cornucopia, flaunting his craft as a poet and performing linguistic begetting and procreation in language. In other words, the falling back of the protagonist narrator on a position of impotent bystander is remedied by the poet-narrator's powerful entry on the stage. The lover-narrator's incapacity to contribute to the conquest of the rose implies twofold impotence: the inability to participate in active combat, and his failure to reproduce in the context of the allegorical conquest of the lady necessary for biological reproduction. The shift to the poet-narrator's perspective symbolically remedies the lover's physical impotence at the level of the authorship of Jean de Meun. In other words, the poet replaces the lover, adopting an authorial point of view that enables him to showcase fertile poetic and linguistic abundance. How does genius come in all of this? The role of the poet-narrator as a fertile linguistic reproducer in a context of warfare is taken over in the poem by the genius character. Genius is staged as nature's priest during the latter part of the conquest, and nature being also, of course, the allegorical character, nature. When Venus's support of the forces of love has proven insufficient and nature's intervention is required, forging new human beings in her divine manner, nature hears with fear about the lover's sort and regrets having created the human race, so reluctant to procreate. After a long complaint /confession to her priest genius is the priest of nature, she urges the latter to carry a universal pardon to mankind at the condition that all will love and procreate to assure their lineages. Jean de Meun's genius character is no doubt one of the most complex allegorical characters of the poem, and is to a large extent borrowed, as is nature's complaint, the passage of nature's complaint, from a text famous in clerical circles at the time, Alain of Lille's De Plancto Naturae, The Complaint of Nature, which is a Latin text in which nature and genius figure more or less in the same roles. As the high priest of nature, dwelling with her in an outer-worldly divine universe, he is a winged, semi-pagan, semi-Christian divinity of genital force, dressed in sacerdotal garments, and who keeps the book of nature, with therein categorized all species. His task is to assure their offspring by excommunicating those who break nature's laws of procreation, such as sodomites, but also those practicing abstinence. Moreover, after descending to earth in front of the rallied troops of love in the poem, genius assumes the light-hearted and more parodial status of a popular preacher, when the god of love ornates him in ironic episcopal garments, a chasuble, a cross staff, a mitre, and a lighted candle. And stages him at the pulpit, from which he rhetorically pronounces an ironic definitive sentence to mankind, quote, put all your tools to work, unquote. That is, relentlessly procreate and multiply. Those who don't will be excommunicated. Those who do are promised salvation in a sort of heavenly park of the Lamb. After his speech, he casts his burning candle that sets the universe aflame, and with renewed vigor, the forces of love now successfully invade the castle and allow the lover to win his rose. So he is the crucial figure in the entire narrative of the allegory, who allows the final impregnation of the rose. There is a stunning proliferation of critical interpretation of Jean Dumas' genius figure in the poem. Scholars mostly attempt to explain, but don't manage, in my view, the discrepancy between his earthly exhortations to procreate and his message of spiritual redemption for those who do. That is the utterly paradoxical message of the procreative act as a metaphor for God's grace that gives us access to eternal life in heaven. And of course, this is in the middle of all the medieval debates on celibacy and abstinence as a way to get spiritual life. However, I would like to emphasize Genius' role, poetic and rhetorical role, as an author figure, and perhaps shed some light on these issues. As firmly as Jean de Meung had imposed his position as poet-narrator when the lover was left paralyzed in the skirmishes around the castle, as decidedly the author Jean de Meung yields to Genius when the battle becomes won between universal forces. The author's preamble to his speech in the poem is accompanied by a marked withdrawal of the poet-narrator, whose voice is afraid to be too imposing. Unlike the speeches by any other allegorical character, Genius' voice becomes a direct extension of that of the author. This transformation of the poet-narrator's voice into Genius is emphasized by a unique staging of the oratorical setting of speaker and audience. Quote, without taking any more time, Genius then mounted on a large platform, the better to read the text. So he's talking here to the allegorical forces defending love and trying to get to the rose. According to the things told about before, love's troops sat on the ground and didn't want to seek any other seats. Genius unfolded the charter, made a sign with his hand and all around him and called for silence. Those whom his words pleased looked and nudged at one another. Then they quieted down immediately and listened while the definitive sentence began, and here the long speech of Genius starts. At the narrative level, the key purpose of Genius' speech is to exhort the forces of love into battle that leads to the victory of the lover's impregnation of the rose. Yet Genius' is not a speech by an inspired commander ready to head his troops to victory. Just like the author, he operates from the sidelines, from a domain detached from the narrative level of the battle. Since it is clearly stated that right after his speech, he mysteriously withdraws back into his outer-worldly realm. Unable to contribute by bodily fighting to the victory of the forces of physical fertility, that is the lover impregnating the rose, Genius in this speech affirms himself at the level of poetic fertility and reproduction. Genius's battle cry, put all your tools to work, is an outspoken, if not desperate, exhortation to procreate, in which the two sets of allegorical tools of fertility that nature has given us, which are, in the poem, hammers and anvils with which to forge objects, and plows and furrows to seed and to plant, are paralleled with a third set designating fecundity in writing and reading, namely the pen and the wax tablet, whereby, of course, the pen clearly refers to a phallic symbol and the wax tablet to the softness of the female sex. For instance, Genius condemns those who do not use their pen to write on the precious tablets that allow all of us to be writers and thus immortal. Quote, those who do not write with their styluses, by which mortals live forever, on the beautiful precious tablets that nature did not prepare for them to leave idle, but instead loan to them in order that everyone might be a writer and that we all, men and women, might live. Those who are so blinded by sin, ironically, that they go tilling the desert ground where their seed is wasted. Those who cannot plow or write or forge on the right forge, may all these be excommunicated and condemned to hell. May they be robbed of their styluses, since they refuse to write with them on the precious tablets fit for that purpose. Genius' spectrum of metaphorical tools, in particular those involving writing, allow us to understand the author's procreative task as one of a universal nature. Writing is just like sex, all can and should participate in it for the sake of procreation. At the same time, genius's example are ultimately his examples are also ultimately, of course, metaphors, and thus poetic procreation of the mind, rather than physical products of the body. Thus, whereas all other allegorical characters remain on the scene of warfare and partake in the concrete battle, genius' contribution, like that of the author, has been to generate poetic language as a mimetic tool to compensate physical impotence. Following Jean de Meung's use of the allegorical genius, Lemaire's Concord of the Two Languages, to which I now talk a little bit about, further substantiates his role as author figure in the sense of fertilization of the vernacular. Lemaire borrows three crucial allegorical characters from the Romans of the Rose: genius, danger, and fair welcome. But genius is by far the most important. And I recall you that at this point, the Romans of the Rose had tremendous popularity in the early Renaissance. It was considered not only the epitome of pure French poetry, as opposed to French poetry as an imitation of classics, but also, in the words of one poet, it was the very blueprint of the French language. So it had importance as a linguistic and poetic document. Lemaire's text is written in an alternation of poetry and prose, and is presented as a debate on the nature of the two languages and in a noble attempt to solidify the cultural alliance between France and Italy, a country that Lemaire had visited numerous times. The poem features an allegorical pilgrimage of the first-person narrator in search of the desired concord of the vernaculars in the Temple of Venus and the Temple of Minerva, but on a number of poetic and moral topics, in particular on the nature of love. Lemaire introduces genius in the Venus Temple, not surprisingly, where the sheer length of his speech and the way in which it reminisces the rose emphasizes the genius' allegorical character. The genius speech is by far the lengthiest passage of the entire poem. The conventional framework of the dream is used when the goddess Venus appears to the poet in his dream, just like in the Romans of the Rose, and introduces him to the Temple of Venus, which is located in Lyon, at the meeting of the Saône and Rhône rivers, Lyon being, of course, the center of Franco-Italian cross-fertilization in the early Renaissance, related with vigorous young men of national origins. Venus Temple is a voluptuousness where poetry and music rival to fill the universe. Its prelate, genius, continues to play the complex role of his character he had in the Rose, as a semi-pagan, archpriest here, and he is, quote, well-dressed in pontifical garment, unquote. He celebrates a sort of pagan mass and produces a sermon on the theme of life's springtime is short, in which he urges mankind to procreate and confirms his role in the universal processes of physical regeneration. The rhetorical and poetic role of the genius character is that Lemaire emulates the Rose staging of genius as a poetic reproducer who assumes the persona of the author in his role of fertilizing the vernacular in times of menacing political and belligerent hostility, which I'll come back in a second. Genius speech glorifying the powers of reproduction is in fact the only instance where an allegorical character, rather than the poet narrator himself, speaks in direct voice from author to genius when the latter is starting to make a speech. And it is said how all youth in the temple, including the poet narrator, fell silent, made themselves ready to listen. Just as the forces of love eagerly gathered around genius in the Romans of the Rose, Lemaire's fictional audience, including the first person voice of the author, keeps quiet in order to allow the voice of genius to resound in the temple. It is stressed once more that genius combines a divine status. He says, I who am your supreme ruler, I am the great sovereign primate, I am the one whom God made shine, he says. That he combines this with rhetorical skills. Genius I am, following you everywhere to preach to you and to persuade you. So he has a clear rhetorical, oratorical setting. His declamatory power becomes even more apparent in the effects of his rhetorically successful movere, moving the audience, after the speech. Quote, at the words of the archpriest genius, several youths of the Gallican and French origin stirred and longing to go to communion without waiting for the sermon to end, as they were filled with amorous fervor, forced the preacher to cut short his homily. It should be stressed that in this passage, genius' speech particularly enthuses the French rather than the Italian youth. This national discrimination strikes us as odd, since before it was said that, quote, the air resounded with French as well as Tuscan and Latin, Tuscan, of course, being Italian. Yet the celebratory singling out of the French and their language can be traced back to Genius' speech itself, in which he had praised the French as, quote, people of Gaul, white as milk, folk so courtly and affable, so proper and handsome, well-formed French, frank and well-bodied and steady in course, fine and fresh, made of steel and fearlessly ferocious. And my hopelessly English translation is also hopelessly losing a wonderful alliteration that is in the French. He's alliterating on the French, the FR sound, which goes more or less like this. François factice, franc fort, fer mauvais, fin, frais de fer, féroce sans frayeur, etc. And it's really a very exuberant phonetic celebration of Frenchness between the sound FR, invoking François, France, but also the sound fer, evoking, of course, fertilité, fertility, and likewise words. So stylistically miming reproduction, fertility at the level of language, literally spoken language. In addition, it should be noted that Genius, as nature's priest, functions both in the Rose and in the Concord as the keeper of the book of nature, in which he inscribes the totality of the natural universe, and he's always sort of reading from the book of nature. In the context of linguistic vernacular, this universal dimension, the book of nature, acquires additional meaning. The moment when the audience keeps quiet in preparation of Genius, also stresses the contrast between Genius's words and the more than 100 or so preceding verses that described Venus Temple and the exuberant musical and vocal universe of singing angels, reciting poets, and playing musicians that resonated throughout the larger cosmos. In other words, Genius's discourse literally replaces, silences this natural and linguistic universe. Uses this contrast to bestow a universality of the French vernacular on the French vernacular. While French and Italian pervaded the temple, speech now fills the temple and the universe. While the text stages no real or allegorical warfare, Genius' exhortations to procreate physically and his fertile universe-pervading vernacular should be read in the context of the need to defend and fortify the French kingdom in the face of hostile threat. We should see this against the background of Lemaire's blatant nationalistic praise of the people of Gaul that we just saw, which was in support of the Gallican politics of his king, Louis XII, who opposed the aggressive anti-French politics of Pope Jules II, who was a particularly belligerent pope. Even more striking is Genius' reference to a more serious and larger hostile menace, the Turks. In fact, the years 1508 to 1510, so right before the publication of this text, saw a renewed interest by the French king and Holy Roman Emperor to mount a crusade to liberate Greece from the Ottoman rule, a situation which is exploited by Lemaire in the text to praise the French warriors, of whom he says, "Your vivid banners are lifted in Asia. The Turks are frightened by your name and fame, and fear and recoil from your impetuosity." So now he sort of slowly starts to indicate that these youth in the temple are in fact warriors, and that they are in fact ready to go out for battle. Whether Lemaire was actually a fervent propagandist of this cause, or rather just a court poet attempting to remain in good political standing, remains to be seen. But it is crucial that the reference to the Turkish peril is made in Genius' speech, since it frames his discourse in a context of warfare, the menace of enemy forces, those of the infidels in particular, to the French kingdom. Genius' conclusion accordingly frames his message of sexual increase and multiply as addressed to the youth of the temple as potential future warriors. He says, "Warm up your limbs and blood while you are in the temple. It is impossible to always bend the bow, since its force would eventually weaken too much. In the meantime, it is better to attend to voluptuousness and cultivate it in imitation of Mars when he had carnal intercourse with Venus." Genius' injunction to the French warriors to rest and indulge in the pleasures of Venus before engaging in battle parallels his rhetorical and poetic fertilization of the French vernacular as a counterpart to physical procreation of the species in times of warfare of the population, if you wish. Jean Lemaire just both politicizes and historicizes Jean de Monts' staging of genius in the belligerent situations as a thriving ground for biological and linguistic begetting by adopting a contemporary political context of menacing destructive forces against which the French kingdom and language have to affirm themselves. In this respect, Lemaire goes even a step further, and the Christian aspect comes back in here. Genius as a linguistic reproducer is endowed with an emphasized nationalistic / ecclesiastical leadership. He is proclaimed, quote, the first of entire Gaul, and primate being the ecclesiastical rank of sort of the archbishop of archbishops. In doing so, Lemaire transfers genius' divine and priest-like status from the Romans of the Rose to that of the Archbishop of Lyon, the ecclesiastical ruler of the Gaule Lyonnaise, one of the four former provinces to constitute Roman Gallia that you refer to also. It is clear that the people of Gaul metonymically designate the French as a whole living in the kingdom. Lemaire makes genius a worldly leader as well as a spiritual divinity. More than Jean de Monts, who doesn't do this at all, Jean Lemaire bestows on genius his ancient nature of the generative founding father of the empire that you talked about, right? The genius of the empire. The dense mixture of pagan and Christian aspects of the genius figure and worldly leader thus contributes to genius' role as founding father of the vernacular nation of France in Jean Lemaire's text. And it's my conclusions. These readings of Jean de Monts' Romans of the Rose and the Concord of, and Jean de Monts' Romans of the Rose and Jean Lemaire's Concord of the Two Languages reveal the allegorical genius figure at the thematic intersection of A, physical procreation of the species in a time of warfare, B, poetic and rhetorical regeneration by an author figure as a form of linguistic replenishment that mimes, that imitates physical begetting, and C, the poetic fertilization and enrichment of the French vernacular. The continuity of this use of genius from Middle Ages to Renaissance, as evinced by the legacy of the Romans of the Rose, allows us to understand his role as the metaphorical extension of that of the author in his task of poetic and linguistic replenishment of the French vernacular. As such, and as substantiated in other texts, such as Rabelais' third book that I alluded to before, the allegorical genius figure offers an appealing alternative to the dominating theory that early modern notions of authorship and of the affirmation of vernacular literature were informed mostly by the need to imitate classical Greek and Roman authors and texts, a view propagated in the 16th century itself by the famous pamphlet of the poet Dubelin, Defense and Illustration of the French Language, in which he encourages French poet to relentlessly pillage ancient poetry and transpose it into the French vernacular. So in other words, my reading attempts to sort of nuance this perspective and say, well, at the same time, there is this genius figure clearly emphasizes sort of a French origin of the French language, not necessarily an imitation of classical rhetorical and poetic models. The genius figure allows us to consider the medieval and early modern concern with poetic and linguistic enrichment of the vernacular as part of a typically French poetic tradition that bridges the Middle Ages and Renaissance. Thank you.